Christianity and Islam. Each of our speakers has up to half an hour to present their ideas to us, and then we're going to have a break. And then we're going to have our speakers respond to each other when we come back for the break. And then we'll have a general discussion of questions. So if you could jot down your questions and your thoughts and responses for the last session. So without further ado, I'd like to, I'm very, very pleased indeed to introduce Professor Julius Lippmann, who teaches Hebrews in the Theology Faculty at Cambridge. Many of you will know Julius's work. He has done a lot of work on all different aspects of Hinduism, on the philosophical traditions, which have become a Mahamudra, really an excellent book on the Mahamudra. He's also famous for his book on Hindus, which will probably be the new book, on which we're looking forward to a second edition in a year or two. And more recently, he's worked on Bengali novels and the Hindu, what might be called the Hindu Renaissance, particularly in Bengal. So I'm very pleased to introduce him, and I'll hand it all over to you then.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. I feel I'm doing a viva, actually, in being in the examination hall. And there were a couple of occasions when I was on the giving end. Now I'm on the receiving end. Well, it's very nice to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. And I'm delighted to meet, of course, Gavin and so many other old friends, and in a special way, Keith Ward, who is going to be another speaker, and my first meeting with Dr. Michaud. So very nice to see you. Since I'm only being given half an hour to talk on surrender to God and Hinduism, let me start very quickly. I won't read it out. I'll just speak to you, and more or less in bullet points, because we are then going to have a question and answer session, and then a general discussion. That's how it's going to be. Well, I may be at a disadvantage here for four reasons. The title of the conference, I can say, if I'm trying to be difficult, and everyone knows I never try to be difficult, is couched in Abrahamic terminology. God. Surrender to God. And by implication, in some minds, all sorts of problematic paradigms can arise. Well, you know, in the Abrahamic traditions, we are talking about a monotheism, which seems to be quite clear-cut. I leave it to my esteemed friend, Professor Ward, to describe how the Trinity is a monotheism, but that's... see, with friends like me, Keith, who needs enemies? But nevertheless, my Muslim and Jewish friends somehow, if I'm too cocky, raise this issue about the monotheism of the Trinity. And so, in any case, the Abrahamic paradigm seems to be different, at least in the minds of many, about the Hindu paradigm. And then another disadvantage might be, in some minds, that purely accidentally, of course, we have a Muslim speaking on Islam, and we have a Christian speaking on Christianity. Whom do we have speaking on Hinduism? I hasten to say I describe myself as a Hindu Christian, so I got it in. But then we are engaged in an academic exercise. And whether you're a Hindu or a Muslim or an atheist or whatever, or a secularist or a humanist, if you're engaged in an academic exercise, you need to develop a critical distance from what you're speaking about. And therefore, since we are engaged in an academic exercise, I don't think, as long as one has empathy with one's subject, I don't think that is a decisive difference. And then perhaps the fourth anomaly, if not disadvantage, because I'm going to turn it into an advantage, is Hinduism as a religious tradition doesn't quite fit the Abrahamic paradigm of what a religion is. It doesn't have a discernible founder. Islam has a prophet, and Christianity has Christ. And you know that there's a big debate going on as to what Hinduism is, and people have described it in so many ways. Certainly it's a coherent whole in respect of certain aspects, and apparently not so in respect of others. And people have called it a family of religions and so on and so forth. I've got my own take on that, which some of you know. And I think that's going to be the advantage of this discourse, this conversation today. Because I'm going to try and identify certain paradigms in Hindu discourse that, at least if they don't challenge the Abrahamic paradigms, at least certainly call for a response and call for an opening of the mind, call for a genuine engagement between the different conversants. So how to go about it? Professor Flood said that we'll do this in chronological order of religion. So we'll start with Hinduism, and then we'll do, I think, Christianity, and then Islam. So I think if you start with Hinduism, then you'll have to do Christianity and Islam at least 3 months into the future, because this tradition is at least 4,000 years old. And it is massive. I mean, it's very old. It's got a huge geographical distribution. The homeland is India. And it's beginning to impact on the world in all sorts of interesting ways, and will continue to do so as India becomes one of the nations to contend with, and Indian civilization, Hindu civilization in particular, because I do not assimilate India to Hinduism. We have the second largest number of Muslims in India and the world, in any one country. But India is going to impact on the world in this century. So if we can find a seminal source, seminal, in ways I will go on to explain, a seminal source which is old and which has influenced important strands of Hinduism, then at least we can get a handle on what we're trying to say. And I'm going to choose the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, as my seminal source, and explain why it's seminal, and explain why it has generated paradigms of thinking about God and the relationship between humans and God, and the goal of human existence in terms of theology and ethics that reverberate throughout very important strands of the Hindu tradition, and particularly the Vedic tradition in the broad sense of that term. So I'm not going to talk about the notion of prapatti or surrender in Vishishtadvaita, which is quite narrow and is quite technically developed. And I'm not going to talk about the notion of surrender or God, particularly in the Bhagavata Purana, which centers around that wonderful expression, Krishnastu Swayam Bhagavan, Lord Krishna, you are God himself. But I'm going to talk about a tradition that is much earlier, and that has generated these paradigms about discourse about God, discourse about human beings and our relationship, which I think we can initiate a genuine dialogue with the other two great faiths that we have represented today. So the Gita, very quickly, traditionally 700 verses, I would put the date of the Gita round about the beginning of the Common Era. It has generated commentaries right from the time it came into being up to the present day. It's more or less part of a theologian's, mainly a Vaishnava theologian's, credentials, even up to the present day, to write a commentary on the Gita, or at least to do a study on the Gita. Srila Prabhupada has done one, Gandhi has done one, and so on and so forth. I mean, it is relevant up to the present, and in fact it played an important role in the nationalist movement in India and so on. So it's not an obscure or researchy text even today. It has great contemporary importance. And it's located in that great epic, the Mahabharata, but it's been treated as a self-contained text, and it has generated devotion and commentary as a self-contained text. And I think that's another reason to select it. So very quickly, because our chairman is fierce in these matters and has said that I can't speak for more than 30 minutes, very quickly I'm going to divide my comments on the Gita into three parts: the philosophical anthropology of the Gita's notion of the self, the theology of the person of God, and of course the relationship between God and the individual and the world, and then the moral teaching of the Gita, because that's very important. The theology is supported by an ethics that I think is very important, very relevant, and very influential. So, to start on the first issue, the philosophical anthropology, the self that surrenders to God under the rubric of this particular conference, very clear, the Gita is dualist. The Gita talks of two dimensions of the human person: the spiritual, under the terms Atman and Purusha, and then the material or the physical, under the term Prakriti. And it's important to remember, and here's the distinction between Cartesian dualism, because in Cartesian dualism, what we call the mind and what we call the passions and so on, you read Descartes on the passions, are all part of the mental, which are not to be reduced to the body, which is determined by extension. But in the Hindu tradition, especially coming through its Sankhya background, which the Gita incorporates and theologizes, in Sankhya and in Gita's philosophical anthropology, the Atman or the spirit is that which has no parts outside of parts. I mean, that's it. It's not about anything else. And only consciousness in its purest form, is a reality that has no parts outside of parts. And they were struggling to try and make sense of it. Is that kind of reality an agent or not? The moment you slap these labels onto that kind of reality, you're already making it partitive. You're already breaking it up. And so there's this constant debate in Hindu theology: is the Purusha Atman a Nyatri, a knower? Is it an enjoyer, Bhoktri? Yes, some say no, and then they qualify. But that's really what's going on. It is not internally divided. And then the prakritic, or the material dimension in inverted commas, includes empirical consciousness, because it is infected with division and differentiation. Includes the buddhi, or what Zaina really badly translates in this otherwise good book as the soul. I mean, the soul is anima, you know, and the buddhi is not soul. The buddhi is prakriti or material. It's the intellective organ, the discriminative organ. And then the outward manifestation of this, the body and all the bodily processes. All this is on one side, Prakriti, as opposed to Purusha or Atman. But it is a dualistic philosophical anthropology, and the two are irreducible to each other. You cannot reduce Purusha Atman to Prakriti, and you cannot reduce Prakriti to Purusha Atman. So that's why I say it's dualistic. And then the Gita says in chapter 2, as some of you no doubt know, bringing out a distinction between these two. And in fact, it's interesting that whereas the Cartesian model explains matter in terms of extension, not very differently, but subtly differently, the Gita explains the body in terms of having parts, parts outside of parts. So you can talk about parts, you can make logical distinctions, but you can't really make some kind of physical or quantitative or any other real distinction. The Atman or Purusha has no parts, and that's really what they're all getting at. So philosophical anthropology, from that point of view, the human person is a composite and is a spirit, and the center of gravity of the human person is the spirit or the self or the Atman or the Purusha. And the human person finds himself or herself embodied in this world with all the implications that flow from that. And the Gita, of course, mainly in chapter 2, explains how this happens in graphic language. Now, remember, this is not a philosophy. This is a teaching. And therefore, to call it, as one of the early Western Orientalists described it, as an ill-assorted cabinet of primitive philosophical beliefs is, I think, to be starting off on the wrong foot. I think he got his genre wrong over there. So now let's say something about the Gita's theology of the person of God. I, as you know, I was sort of born and brought up in India, and I came across many Christian and Muslim questions about and views about Hinduism even before I seriously started to study the subject. Or in fact descriptions of it as polytheistic, as idolatrous, and so on and so forth. And I found out that you can manipulate the word idolatry in different ways, and most people are idolaters in one way or another, depending on who their particular god is at the moment. Money for a great many, but doesn't matter. And polytheistic it is not. You can manipulate the word polytheistic either, but that it is not. It's fiercely monotheistic. But as someone said, it's polymorphic monotheism. It's not. It's not the kind of monotheism that you find in Islam and Judaism. And I'm hoping that Professor Ward will say it's not the kind of monotheism you also find in Christianity, but it's monotheistic. And we go back just for a moment to Krishna's Tu Swayam Bhagavan. Krishna, you are the Lord alone. You are God. You are the one who out of which every reality comes and on which every reality is dependent. And for me, that's a pretty good definition of God. But the Gita is much more specific. If by God you mean a being that is omniscient, who knows everything, not chronologically, but at the same time, is all-knowing, however you then go on to describe it, omnipotent, and of course the mark of omnipotence is to bring beings into existence, inside or outside time, doesn't matter, omnipotent, and benevolent and compassionate as well. This is what you mean by monotheism. Every other form of being depends for its existence on that being. Then the Gita is monotheistic, and there is no dispute about it. I can't spend a lot of time trying to back this up. But now this is where things begin to change or take a different turn, and this is where I'm inviting my co-speakers to consider what is distinctive about Hinduism. In the Muslim and Christian doctrines of the originative production of being, rather than using the word creation, you have this notion of bringing beings out of nothing. Now, I suggest that that is a very interesting way of speaking, and it makes sense, it's intelligible. But the image is associated with it. The image is associated with the Abrahamic doctrine of creation. are images of transcendence. The Christian tradition, which I'm more familiar, studied myself for many years, as you know, classic doctrines of creation talk about creation ex nihilo sui et subjecti, the creation of something out of nothing, out of nothingness absolutely, out of nothing that existed before. It's a total act of originative production. And you will find in the images that go in these traditions of creation the sense of transcendence, the absoluteness of God, the gap between the finite and the infinite. And these traditions have to work very hard to show the intimacy, the ontological and otherwise other intimacy of the Supreme Being with what has been created. And Christians have done this through sophisticated doctrines of the incarnation. You have comments in Islam about God, Allah, peace be upon him, being closer to you than your jugular vein, and so on and so forth. But for a Hindu, this is a labored way of talking and thinking. Because in the Hindu tradition, and this is a paradigm that you first see developed in the Gita, not philosophically developed, but developed imaginatively and developed conceptually and developed linguistically. Krishna says, the whole world is part of my being, part of my nature. And if you look at 7:7, and I'll have a quick, after I've insulted Zaina, I'm using his text, I'm sure he'll forgive me. 7:7, I'll use his translation. Higher than me there is nothing whatsoever. On me this universe is strung like clustered pearls upon a thread. Higher than me there's nothing whatever. And you think, okay, well that could be an infinite series or a series in the same order of being or whatever. And then in Gita 7:4, Krishna says, and this is distinctive Hindu talk, I have two prakritis, two natures. The lower nature, which is all the material world, eightfold is my nature, earth, water, fire, air, space, mind, soul, ego. And then the higher nature is all the cells, the atmans, the purusha, the spirits are my nature. And you say, oh, you're collapsing the world into Krishna. This is some pantheistic discourse. And whenever the Gita says that, it says invariably a transcendently corrective statement. That is not an accident. It says, but they exist in me, I do not exist in them. So Krishna corrects that impression that everything dissolves in him and that it's some kind of pantheism. And this is just the Hindu way of discoursing. We have to think outside the box and realize that the intimacy of the ontological relationship, the ontological intimacy is great. They're not talking about creating out of nothing, because out of nothing, nothing comes. But they're talking about absolute power, originative production, but tremendous intimacy as well. And if you look at the images of creation, of production of being in Hinduism, it has to do with dismemberment, the womb of being, production from within, and etc., etc. So it's a much more intimate form of immanence exists in a dialectic with transcendence. And I suggest, and this is a provocative statement, that in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, immanence suffers at the hands of transcendence. That intimacy, that closeness of God. You don't have the imaginative material in terms of his philosophy to sustain it in any intimate way. And I'd like to hear the responses to that. But in Hinduism you do, and you find that these images appearing powerfully in the Gita. The second thing is, Krishna is the descender. I don't like to use the word the one who incarnates. I've written a whole article on the difference between avatara and incarnation, so they are two separate terms. And when you use Krishna incarnates, you're importing a great deal of Christian emotional and theological weight over there. Avatara, avatri, avatarati, to come down. Krishna descends. And he can descend in many forms. But this is a mark of compassion and benevolence. And the first time in Hinduism that you find a serious statement about God caring for human beings enough to take on human form, not become a human, take on human form, so that he can be among us and one of us and converse with us and discourse with us and sangharsha and engage with us, you find in the Gita. And this, of course, is in chapter 2, and it's very well known. Krishna comes down again and again in order to establish dharma and to chastise the evildoers and to support the virtuous. And this has echoed, I mean, the Bhagavata Purana has referenced, I think, 22 avatars, and that's not the point. What I'm looking at is the principle behind it, which you'll find for the first time in the Bhagavad Gita, that you have a benevolent, compassionate, loving God who puts his money where his mouth is, as it were, and comes down and says, I'm here with you and for you. That's very, very important. So Krishna is not an avatara in the Gita. Krishna is an avatarin. Krishna is the one who comes down. And some say, okay, but he's the avatar of Vishnu. Well, Krishna uses the word Vishnu and Krishna uses the word Shiva also in the Gita. I am Vishnu, I am Shiva. So that's not the point. He is the avatarin. I've got all the references if you want this in discussion. Now, this love, and I've heard Christian missionaries criticize or think they've criticized Hinduism. Krishna responds to the devotee. Krishna responds. So first the devotee has to come to Krishna and then Krishna responds. No, not in the Gita. It is a preemptive love. Krishna takes the initiative. And your clock is running slow. So I hope you realize that. So it's a preemptive love. And if you look at texts which actually try and bring this out, Krishna says in the fourth chapter, if I were not to keep the worlds in existence, everything would crash. I keep the world in existence, I take the initiative, and that is why people follow my example. You know, spiritual people think God loves everybody equally. True. Krishna says it. I look at everyone with an impartial eye. If God loves everyone equally, why are some people saints and some people sinners? Why is it the case that some people feel that they are favorites of God? And this is in Christianity, this is in Islam, this is in Hinduism. The spiritual world is similar in very important ways. And surprisingly, the great Advaitin theologian, Shankara, gives a very interesting explanation in his commentary on Gita 9.29. Gita 9.29, very quickly, in all contingent beings the same am I, Krishna speaking. None do I hate and none do I fondly love. Na me dveshyo asti na priyaha. But those who love me in true devotion abide in me and I in them. We share this relationship. And in his commentary, Shankara says, paraphrasing, I'm like a fire. Just as a fire does not banish the cold from those who stand afar. So the fire is blazing here. If you stand at the end of the room, you're not going to get warmed. The fire is giving its heat preemptively to begin with. inviting everyone. The closer you come to the fire in response, the warmer you get. So it's a wonderful explanation for those who experience through their response to this love, the warmth of God's love. And at the same time, God can say, I don't have favorites. So you are saved and you are damned in a predetermined way. So that's so much, it's very few words. And now finally, the last 5 minutes, the ethics of the Bhagavad Gita. Because theology is not enough. If theology cannot be supported by an adequate ethics, then it seems to be hanging in the air. And the ethics of the Gita is well known. Act. After all, this is on a battlefield that Krishna is speaking the words to Arjuna, his disciple. And the physical combat that is about to start is the symbol of the spiritual combat. Kurukshetra Dharmakshetra. This is how the battle, this is how the Gita begins. Kurukshetra Dharmakshetra. On the field of Kuru, the Kuru field, on the field of Dharma. Kshetra Kshetra Dharma Kuru. In every field do your Dharma. The ethics of the Gita is really act out of love for God, but not for the fruit of the action. And the Gita is very specific. This is what made such a big impact in the nationalist movement and for Hindu patriotism. I act because it's my duty, even to the point of losing my life, but not for any physical or worldly gain. I act out of devotion to God. Now, this is a very powerful ethic because it's a selfless ethic. It's an ethic of abnegation, of renunciation. But it is an ethic of action too, because it is the powerhouse of acting in the world. The last comment I make is, you may think that this is rather individualistic. Both Islam and Christianity have a greater stress on the community. And in different ways, no doubt. And in fact, in Christian theology, the community, the social dimension is very important, the communitarian dimension. The Gita is, you can winkle out, you can work out aspects of community in the Gita, but I think the social dimension is not strongly developed in the Gita. And Hinduism has, I think, rightly been accused of not having enough, of being too individualistic, not having enough of that social dimension, the community, as part of the theology. But the Gita has influenced other important texts like the Narada Bhakti Sutras, which were written in about 1,000 years later. And there are, I had this all prepared, but the chairman is fixing me with a fierce eye. The Gita clearly influences the Narada Bhakti Sutra, where you have an efflorescence of bhakti, different kinds of bhakti, devotion and so on. But it brings out the community aspect of that devotion more clearly. So the Gita has not been without influence in that respect too. And if you look at, again, Ramanuja's Vishishtadvaita and the special development of the doctrine of prapatti, surrender to God, total surrender to God. Gita, what's it, 2.9? Shishyaste ham shadhi mam tvam prapannam. Prapannam. I am your disciple, shadhi mam tvam. Teach me prapannam, who surrender to you totally. The word prapannam is used, which afterwards, 1,000 years later, Vishishtadvaita and other philosophies then develop in a more technical, theological sense. So the Gita certainly has this sense of a real God. It's a realist philosophy, who is truly God, and therefore it's monotheistic. A human being who surrenders everything to God, surrenders the fruit of all action, but lives in such an intimate communion with God that you can talk of God dwelling in the human being in God. In fact, we live in God. We are the lower nature of God. We are part of God. So I think it's an extremely rich, but it has very distinctive paradigms, which I think Islam and Christianity are not particularly comfortable with. I think, frankly, to their loss. To their loss. And this is a provocative statement. And I think Hinduism, as I've acknowledged, in my reading of the tradition, needs to develop a greater sense of salvation as a more greater sense of social dimension, which Gandhi and all the people did. And that's what a great religion does. It, Seva Dharma, the dharma of service, is what Gandhi developed. And that has a very strong social dimension. So this has happened through dialogue with Christianity in Hinduism. And I think that I think it will repay more discussion, more study, more dialogue, honest dialogue, where traditions can learn from one another in the way I've suggested. So I'm sorry it's so brief, and I'm sorry that there's not much more I had the time to say, because I have a lot of different sub-points that I can make, and references and so on, which I've prepared. But let's stick to the basic points and the paradigms of creation, the paradigms of humanity, the paradigms of action and so on that the Gita has offered Hinduism in very important ways right up to the present day. Thank you very much.
Most of the points that you are
most bullet points, as I said.